Well, you've got to go back and look at how the Russians were able to develop a rocket, space technology anyway. What they did after World War II was American forces were held back for a while the Soviets occupied East Germany. They stripped East Germany. They took back the latest of the V-2 rocket technology from Peenemünde and other places. And the V-2 became the basis of the Russian space technology. Now, if you skip the intervening years, you will find when you come to the early 1970s that the Russians did not have the capability to MIRV their missiles. And in particular, they lacked the ability to produce the very precision, micro-miniature ball bearings that are needed for the control systems. There was only one company in the world, Bryant, Chuck and Grinder, which could make the machinery which machines the races which within which these ball bearings run. And without those races, you just cannot make MIRV missiles in any quantity. You can make one off, but not in quantity. Bryant, Chuck and Grinder was allowed to ship to the Soviet Union 45 of these machines at a time when we only had 33 in the United States.
But wasn't there any objection to doing this?
I objected at Miami Beach in 1972. Other people objected, but the objections were squashed. And predominantly at fault here is Henry Kissinger and the incoming Nixon administration. This was known. I'm sure it was known in DOD. If I knew it, then certainly DOD knew it. But the objections were squashed, and there was suppression of the information.
And so once again, we see America building up the military capacity, the nuclear threat from the Soviet Union.
Well, this goes, you know, when you talk about MIRVing of missiles, you're talking about a quantum jump in your military technology. Now, I'm not a military man, but to me, the ability to do that is a massive leap forward. And we enabled them to do it, and we did it knowingly and deliberately.
During the Vietnamese War, the Soviet Union and the Eastern European satellites were the primary suppliers of war materials to the North Vietnamese who were killing American boys in South Vietnam. Would you comment on our aid and trade with the Soviet Union and with the Eastern European satellites during that period of time?
Well, there's no question that the Soviets were the prime suppliers of military equipment and supplies to the North Vietnamese. Let me give you an example. The American pilots, as they flew over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, described the trucks that they were seeing as American trucks. Well, they were American trucks because they came from the Gorky plant, and Gorky was built by Henry Ford. And so you have the situation where we were, in effect, supplying both sides in the Vietnamese War.
But the trucks were being built by the Soviet Union. However, were they getting any materials from the United States to help build those trucks?
Yes, in the early 1970s, I know specifically of shipments of equipment into the Gorky plant while the war was going on, which in effect were aiding the Soviets to build more trucks to be used by the North Vietnamese.
How about loans? Was America extending loans to the Soviet Union during this period when they were the primary financiers of the North Vietnamese?
Yes. Beginning about 1970, there was a massive grant of loans to the Soviet Union. I'd say by about 1976, it must have totaled perhaps $40 billion outstanding. And so this, of course, these loans were used to enable the Soviet Union to purchase industrial equipment in the United States, and this industrial equipment was used to manufacture, in part, military supplies, which were used against us in Vietnam.
How about Russian shipping that was being used to ferry supplies to North Vietnam?
Shipping is a very interesting example, because the Soviets published a shipping register, about 6,000 ships, and I analyzed every one of these ships, both the origin of the technology of the ship itself, the hull, and the engine. Most of them are marine diesel engines. And I find that 60% of the Soviet merchant marine, which of course has military usefulness, 60% was built aboard. Only 40% in the Soviet Union, and that largely to Western design. But when you come to marine diesel engines, you find something really fascinating. You find that 80% of the marine diesel engines in Soviet merchant ships are Western engines, Burmeister and Wayne of Copenhagen, Sulzer of Switzerland, Fiat of Italy, because that name has come up before. But the other 20% of marine diesel engines built in the Soviet Union are built to Western design under technical assistance contracts from Sulzer and Burmeister and Wayne. So in effect, there could be no Soviet merchant marine without assistance from the West.
How about the building of the Kama River plant?
Kama River was built in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The basic design, the contract, was let to the Italian firm of Fiat. Giovanni Agnelli is the chairman of the board. And this is important because Agnelli is tied in with Chase Manhattan Bank. He's on the International Advisory Committee of Chase Manhattan. What caught my attention was that Fiat does not manufacture automobile manufacturing equipment. All the Fiat plants in Italy contain American equipment. And what I found was that the equipment was coming, perhaps about 60-70% of it, from the United States, from major automobile equipment suppliers in the United States. I think it was known as the Fiat plant as a cover to perhaps divert attention from the fact that during the Vietnamese War, we were building the largest plant in the world. It covers 36 square miles. We were building for the Soviets, with American equipment, the largest plant in the world. And so it was called the Italian Fiat plant, and I think this was a blank.
And so they were building their trucks and armored personnel carriers and other things that could be used then for warfare in South Vietnam?
We knew that the Karma plant had military potential. In 1972, I wrote it in National Suicide. I said as much in Miami Beach in 1972. This plant has military potential. It can produce military vehicles. We knew it. And of course, today in Afghanistan, we find that the Karma vehicles that are there in Afghanistan today from the Karma plant built by American and Italian companies.
And it was after you brought out this information that efforts were made to suppress your book, National Suicide,
yes,
and your other studies?
Yes, because I was bringing out the fact that the Karma River plant had military potential, that we were moving the missiles with the Bryant chucking grinder equipment, and of course, other facts along these lines.
And what sort of pressure was brought to bear upon you? What sort of pressure was brought to bear upon the publisher of your book, National Suicide?
There was pressure on the publisher to prevent publication, to stop publication. He refused to do so. There's pressure brought upon me first to withdraw the book, and then a rather deceitful sort of pressure. It was claimed at the Hoover Institution that I had plagiarized volume 3 of my Western Technology series, which was being published by Stanford University. Well, firstly, I challenged them to point out the plagiarization, and nobody could find even two sentences that matched up. But then I pointed out that I cannot plagiarize my own work. I hold a copyright on both books, and nowhere in the world can I plagiarize myself. That's a logical impossibility. And then gradually it built up over the following years that my research was perhaps going a little out of what was perhaps required, or welcome would be a better word, and it should be confined within more narrow boundaries. And at that point in 1975, I left the Hoover Institution, and since then I've become an independent author, and I can publish what I want to publish.
Do you know of any other instances where efforts were made to suppress publication of books through the Hoover Institute?
I know one example, when I was personally aware of, and that was Julius Epstein's book on Operation Cube Hall, which is a very important book on the treatment of Russian prisoners of war in Germany after World War II. This book was in manuscript for several years, and he was not allowed to publish it. I heard that firsthand from Julius.
Right, and eventually it was, of course, brought out.
It was at a later point. Now, another example I can give you is my own Western Technology series. The third volume of that was held in galleys for 1 year. Now, it costs a lot of money to hold a book in galleys, because when a book is in galleys, you want to get it out on the market to start recouping your investment. That book was held in galleys for 1 year because it was not politically wise or acceptable to publish it at that time, even though it was an academic book.
Now, you've done some fascinating studies on the Trilateral Commission. Can you tell us about the Trilateral Commission?
The Trilateral Commission is a private organization founded by David Rockefeller in 1973. It was essentially financed by Rockefeller and some of the foundations, Kettering Foundation, Danforth Foundation, Ford Foundation. Ford Foundation was a very major contributor. And the stated objective is to encourage discussion amongst what they call the trilateral regions. I should point out that of the 300 members, one-third come from the United States, one-third from Japan, and one-third from Europe. But in effect, I find that the actions of the Trilateral Commission are very much self-interested on the part of the international banking community in New York.
Now, as far as the Trilateral Commission's influence on the American government is concerned, it's been said that there was a very excessive representation of the Trilateral Commission in Jimmy Carter's cabinet and in Jimmy Carter's administration.
Well, excessive is rather an understatement, I think. There's some 200 million people in the United States. There are only 77 trilateral members who are American. Out of that 77, I counted no fewer than 18 trilateralists. That's about one-third of the trilateral American trilateral contingent turns up in the Carter administration. Mr. Carter himself is a trilateral, Mr. Mondale, Mr. Brown, Mr. Vance, Mr. Blumenthal, Mr. Brown, Secretary of Defense. In other words, they occupy all the senior cabinet and sub-cabinet posts. In fact, there's some key committees, intelligence and defense committees, which are only comprised of trilaterals. So here you've got 77 Americans selected by one man, David Rockefeller, who's chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and we find that they turn up in the key controlling positions in Washington under the Carter administration.
And would this suggest to you that perhaps we do not select the government, that it is selected by these people who work behind the scenes?
You can come to no other conclusion. If you look today at who's running for office, you find Mr. Bush is a trilateral, you find Mr. Anderson is a trilateral, Mr. Carter is a trilateral.
We find articles appearing in Newsweek magazine, Time magazine, U.S. News and World Report, many of the major media telling us there's really nothing to be concerned about from the Trilateral Commission. Is there any interlock between the Trilateral Commission and the major media in the United States?
Yes, there is an interlock, particularly in the news media. For example, the Chicago Sun-Times, the executive editor there, James Hoagie, is a trilateral. You'll find Saul Leinowitz is a director of Time magazine. And I think, yes, Henry Schacht is a director of CBS. So there very definitely is an interlock between the trilaterals and the media.
And perhaps this is the reason, then, that they rather play down the influence of the Trilateral Commission on contemporary American government.
Yes, I had a computer survey made of all articles that have been printed on the Trilateral Commission since 1973. I could find worldwide only 73 articles.
Now, what's the relationship between the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations?
Well, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is a much older organization, founded in 1920. I did a study in which I compared trilaterals with or without membership in the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. I find there's something over 50% overlap.
In Senator Goldwater's book, With No Apologies, on page 280, he wrote, "The Trilateral Commission is intended to be the vehicle for multinational consolidation of the commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States." Anthony Sutton lives in seclusion now, as with so many men who have documented the influence of America's invisible government on our society. He lives with a certain amount of concern for his safety, because you see, those who have documented the fact that we have an invisible government and that both political parties in America are controlled by the same identical people, those people, of course, their lives are in danger. Let me point out that since 1953, all but one Secretary of State has come from the membership list of the Council on Foreign Relations. Since 1953, all but one Undersecretary of State has come from the membership list of the Council on Foreign Relations, and all but one Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And every head of the Federal Reserve Board has come from the membership list of the Council on Foreign Relations. Of the last 9 American presidents, 6, possibly 7, have come from the membership list of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is indeed the invisible government of the United States.
We're now going to hear another soundtrack from a YouTube video, this time one for more familiar speaker on the show, Chris Busby, speaking at the Royal Society on Scientific Dishonesty.
And the reason for this is that a lot of this stuff doesn't get into the peer review literature. You can do research and you can send it to the peer review literature, and as I shall show later on, it doesn't go anywhere. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we found in Finch, and I'm going to try and talk a little bit also about what maybe we should do about this, and I'm also going to talk about some of the people, some of the actual actors involved in translating science into policy who didn't do what they should have done. And I'm going to talk about some other actors who are actually dishonest in some of the work that they did. Now, the point is that that democracy depends upon policymakers having knowledge of the areas that they are dealing with. And of course, when democracy first began in the 19th century, Everybody could understand more or less everything that was going on. You didn't need science. You did scientists who understood complicated esoteric issues. But this has changed. And so, of course, now we have a situation where most politicians know very little. Politicians are generally scientifically illiterate. I can say this because we've done a survey of the British politicians. We did a survey in 2000, my colleagues and I, of the MPs in Parliament, and we found that they actually, most of them had very few qualifications in science, and a lot of them had no qualifications in mathematics. So for them to be able to understand anything scientific was virtually impossible. They had to rely upon scientists, upon expert scientific committees. We published this in this book called I Don't Know Much About Science, But I Know What I Like. And that seems to be how it works. Now, scientific committees, in turn, depend upon peer-reviewed literature, and they ignore the grey literature. And recently, we've seen that actually they ignore the peer-reviewed literature as well, because what they do now in scientific committee advice committees is they have a level below which they don't consider anything at all. So they now are getting to the position where they will only consider literature that's published in the Journal of the Royal Society, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, in Nature, in the British Medical Journal. But if you happen to publish in some, you know, slightly less important or fancy-sounding journal, then they will not consider it at all. And if you look at the very latest reports on ionizing radiation, Unsteer and the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committee of the National Academy of Sciences in the USA, huge numbers of publications that show all sorts of things about ionizing radiation are just excluded. They're not in the literature at all. They're not in the references, and they're not referred to. So we also found, when we were looking through this issue, that, in fact, there's a considerable amount of bias in interpretation. For example, Christina Rudin, from the Karolinska Institute, a philosopher, wrote three very important papers on the translation of trichloroethylene carcinogenicity, and showed in these three papers that the European Union didn't define the carcinogenicity of trichloroethylene because of bias. And this is because of the affiliation of the people who were making the scientific advice. So peer review literature is often biased by the affiliation of the researchers, the reviewer, or the editor. The literature may be biased by the choice of the research topic, therefore who funds the research. Obviously, if nobody funds the research, you're not going to discover anything. If you decide to do some research into mobile phones and health and they won't give you any money to do it, then of course there will be no evidence that mobile phones cause harm to health. And that's what the politicians can then say. And of course, peer-reviewed literature may be so brushed and spun as to approach dishonesty, and it may in fact have false data, and it may indeed be dishonest. And because you're such a wonderful audience, I have decided with Roger here to give you all a copy of my book, Wolves of Water, so everyone here can have a copy. It's a Christmas present, if you like, from Green Audit. And all of the stuff that I'm saying here, you'll find in that book, so you can then read it at a slightly greater length, because there's not a lot of time to go into this too much. And what we have to recollect, and of course, as you all know, that the consequences of this dishonesty, or this bias, or the spin, or whatever it is we want to call it, is the illness and death of hundreds and thousands of people. And I can show, and I have shown in Wolves of Water, that this has happened, that this biased, dishonest advice from expert committees has resulted in these deaths. And currently, there's no law in this country, in the UK, against this sort of dishonesty or biased advice. Nothing can be done about it. Culprits are not seen as criminals. They're just seen as people who maybe they got it wrong, perhaps we should forgive them, and so forth. But so there's no such thing as a scientific crime, it seems to me. And it's about time now, in 2007, that we should have such a thing as a scientific crime. We should decide that there is such a thing. And in this country, there's no independent committee on scientific dishonesty, although there are in other countries. In Denmark, for example, there is one, and I think in Sweden, too. So how can we judge scientific dishonesty? How could it be criminal? What sort of ethical framework could we apply? Well, in British courts, evidence in, say, a criminal action, if somebody is being murdered, for instance, and you go in as a witness, if you tell a lie, if you say, well, I was there at the time and he didn't kill his wife, or he was with me in the pub having a beer when his wife was killed, or whatever, and later it's discovered that actually that wasn't true, you can go to jail. You can go to jail for perjury. But this doesn't seem to be the case as far as scientists are concerned. Scientists can talk absolute nonsense, they can tell lies, they can give false or biased information, they can fit up data. Nothing happens to them. So I submit in the present system of science and policy that the same argument should be applied. And because of the serious and real consequences of scientific evidence on human health, that they should have the same responsibility as witnesses in a criminal case. And so if they tell lies or if their data is spun or if it's dishonest, and of course they could be tried in a court in the same way as anybody else. I'm not suggesting any sort of kangaroo court. And I'm going to put up a few people here for you to look at in order to decide whether or not what they did was dishonest. Because I'm not going to say whether they were dishonest or not, but I'm going to give you the evidence that they were. And all of this evidence has been given elsewhere, incidentally, so this is nothing new. And a lot of it is in Wolves of Water, which has been published now for about a year now. I've attacked a lot of these scientists publicly. I've attacked them in committees that I've been on them with, and the arguments have gone on and on. But I'm going to just present to you the sort of thing that happens in the real translation of real science into real policy, which results in the sort of situation that we're considering at the moment. But it's not just simply a matter of someone having made a mistake. There are people there who are dishonest, who are biased, or perhaps because of culture, they are pushing the science in the wrong sort of direction. I'll give some examples here of policy where people have died as a result of false evidence or spun data or dishonest culturally biased scientific advice. A very good one is the BSC CJD. This is mad cow disease. We had an expert committee who ignored scientists like Professor Richard Lacey, who brought evidence that the agent crossed the species barriers. Many people died. The chair of that committee was Sir Richard Southwood, who at the time was also the chair of the National Radiological Protection Board, who advised the government that the Chernobyl effects wouldn't last and that all of the cesium-137 would leave the country after about 6 weeks. Well, there's still parts of North Wales and Yorkshire and Cumbria where the cesium-137 is still there and they're under sheep restriction movements. Chernobyl. Now, NRPP and the infant leukemias. Now, after Chernobyl, there was a sharp increase in infant leukemia. This is leukemia in children who were in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl radiation. It was reported by several different groups in different countries in Europe. There's not just one report. And taken together, it showed that there was an excess risk that could not be described by the risk model of the ionizing of the ICRP. That is the current risk model for ionizing radiation protection. And they were out by a factor between 100 and 500 times, which is about the right number to explain the Sellafield leukemia cluster as well, of childhood leukemia. So ionizing radiation causes childhood leukemia, but for some reason, the official committee in this country and also the shadow committee, CAMARE, both of those committees did nothing at all and didn't advise the government. Trichloroethylene carcinogenicity I've already talked about. And then radioactive pollution and cancer following the Sellafield child leukemia cluster. There was a high-level cover-up of the effects of low-dose internal radiation exposure involving these committees. CAMARE, this is the Committee on Medical Aspects of Radiation in the Environment, Small Area Health Statistics Unit. Both of these agencies were set up, committees were set up by the government following an inquiry into the Sellafield leukemia cluster in 1983 by Sir Douglas Black. And more recently, uranium weapons, the Royal Society. Here we are in the Royal Society. I've been here twice before giving evidence to the Royal Society Committee on Depleted Uranium. And then, of course, we have mobile phones and cancer. So I'm going to now talk a little bit about individual cases in this area of ionizing radiation and health. I'm going to present brief accounts of the behavior of five individuals in the area of radiation and health. Now, if this were a court of law and in another country, for instance, with thalidomide in Germany, the charge could be manslaughter by accessory to mass poisoning. People in Germany went to jail because of thalidomide. The directors of that company went to jail. But not in England. But in fact, it was Glaxo in England that was marketing that substance. So the directors in England, nothing happened to them. Glaxo just continued going. So I'm going to invite some discussion, maybe not in the time that's available, but in your minds, or over lunch, or perhaps generally in your hearts, about the extent to which the behavior of the scientists that I present here can be seen as scientifically dishonest, and I'd say this criminal, culturally biased, because this is a possibility. You know, you live in a particular area, in a particular pond, and it's your culture to dismiss things that don't fit in with what it is you believe. And so in a court of law, you might argue that this person was just misguided. or innocent by virtue of stupidity, and I've met a few people like that as well. But in all cases, I have to say that the results of this behaviour, and if you're stupid and you drive a car and you kill somebody, the charge is manslaughter, has resulted in a lot of deaths. The first person is the chair of the Cherry Committee. The committee examining radiation risks from internal emitters was set up by Michael Meacher in 2001 in order to examine the argument that internal radiation, that's radiation from particles inside the body or radionuclides that were bound to the DNA and were decaying from inside the body on the DNA, that these substances could not be considered in the same way as external radiation because of the anisotropy of dose, because the dose is all in one place, like eating a hot coal rather than sitting and warming yourself in front of the fire. The idea was to take evidence from all sides and carry out studies and provide a final report after 3 years showing these areas of agreement and areas of disagreement. Well, Goodhead started by setting up an epidemiologically a subcommittee where all three sides, that's the nuclear industry, myself, and the National Radiological Protection Board, all got the same data on the same study, a study that I'd already done on Bradwell, which is a power station in Essex that releases radionuclides to the estuary nearby, and there was a large increase in breast cancer around this estuary, a statistically significant doubling. And all of this is described in Wolves of Water, so I won't go on about it here. So when we set up this subcommittee, we tried to obtain the data, but in fact what happened was that Michael Meacher was sacked about halfway through the Cherry Committee. When it started to look as if we might be finding something, the Minister of the Environment, Michael Meacher, said, no, we're not talking about Mickey Mouse here, we're talking about large, big dogs, big forces. The minister was sacked by the government, by Tony Blair, and immediately there was a blockage in the development of this epidemiological study. And before the end of the committee was wound up, because it was rapidly wound up after Meacher went, what happened was that Goodhead said that this study can't go ahead. At the same time, one of the members of the secretariat, Marion Hill, who was a person from the nuclear industry, so not somebody from our side, resigned from the committee and wrote a letter, which is reproduced in Wolves of Water, accusing the chair of bias and collusion with another member of the secretariat in order to bias the proceedings of the Cherry Committee. This is a British government committee on the effects of ionizing radiation on health. Okay, we're talking major stuff here, big politics. So following the loss of Meacher, Goodhead, having initially agreed, having later been reminded by Meacher of his agreement, refused to include any dissent in the final Cherry report. He knocked both of the epidemiological studies on the head. And what we had to do was we had to produce a minority report. It was around about the time of that film with Tom Cruise, so it was recorded the minority report. So as a result of this, this study was never done. Now, if it had been done, it would have shown that there was this increase in breast cancer around the estuary near Bradwell. This is Bradwell nuclear power station. The material goes into the mud here. There's another muddy estuary here where the risk factor was the same as the national population. So the risk was all associated with being near the mud. All right, enough good then. Now we're going to talk about Sarah Darby. This is an argument that was carried out in the Cherry Committee. Sarah Darby was brought in by Professor Goodhead, who described her as an independent epidemiologist. She's quite a famous epidemiologist. She still is. She did a lot of nuclear work on atomic bomb veterans in collaboration with Professor Sir Richard Doll, who has died. Now, both of these two did these studies on the A-bomb veterans, which I can argue with, and which I think were very biased and very wrong, had all sorts of epidemiological problems. Design problems and wrong conclusions. But I'm going to talk about the Nordic leukemia study, which was published in the British Medical Journal in 1993. What that showed was that there was no increase in childhood leukemia at the large peak in weapons fallout, which occurred around about 1959 to 1963. The argument, which at that time was important because of the Sellafield leukemia cluster court case, which was going on at the time, was that if there had been a relationship between the sorts of materials coming out of Sellafield and levels of childhood leukemia, you would have seen it in the data when the largest injection of these materials into the planetary atmosphere occurred, which was about 1959 to 1963, from the atmospheric tests. And this is the this is Darby's graph, from just taken from the British Medical Journal, this one here at the top. You can see it just goes along ziggity-ziggity-ziggity-ziggity-ziggity, and basically nothing much is going on. And on the basis of this, they argued that there was no effect from the injection of weapons fallout. This is when the bombs went off, see? However, when I asked Darby for her data, because I discovered that actually it wasn't a continuous time series of the Nordic registries, which is what she'd argued, but actually splicing together of two different registries, the Danish registry before 1960, and after 1960, the combined registries of Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, and Finland, which is a much larger population, you understand. And you could have seen that on the noise. She said that the data had been destroyed. She told this to the committee, and she said this in writing. There's no argument about it. The data had been destroyed, cannot be discovered, you cannot see what's in there, you cannot deconvolute Denmark in order to see whether, if you look at Denmark right the way through and take out and all the others, was there something there? So I wrote to the British Medical Journal and complained, and I said, I want the ethical committee to have a go at her about this. And I went to Copenhagen, and I went to see the original founder of the Danish Cancer Registry, Johannes Clemmensen, and he gave me the original data. And meanwhile, what happened was that Darby suddenly miraculously found the data which had been destroyed, and she gave it to the British Medical Association, who sent it to me. Okay, what did it show? This is what it showed. If you looked at the Danish data, and here's Darby's graph, Danish data sort of rather large peak in childhood leukemia, which was about what you'd expect on the basis of other studies that had been done with internal radiation around about that time. Now, I'm not saying I'm not arguing about whether or not there's a relationship between childhood leukemia and ionizing radiation. I mean, I think I know what the relationship is and have done enough work on it. What I'm talking about is that this should never have happened. This was a biased research paper which actually affected policy. And when I was talking to NRPB in 1996 about this issue of childhood leukemia near the Irish Sea, they quoted this study as showing that there was no effect on childhood leukemia from internal radiation. Now, Darby and Dolk never cited any of the previous work that showed that there was such an effect. And in three Danish papers, and a cancer registry report also showed that this data was there, but none of this was cited in the paper in the British Medical Journal. Now, is this criminal? Is it biased? Is it dishonest? What is it? It's certainly something. Next person, Dr. John Stewart. Well, you don't know Stewart. Stewart took over the running of the Wales Cancer Intelligence and Surveillance Unit. There's a photograph of him in Wales of Water, and there's several chapters devoted to my work with the Irish government looking at the increases in cancer around the shores of the Irish Sea, which is massively contaminated with uranium, plutonium, cesium, you know, all of this stuff that's been pumped out from Sellafield into the Irish Sea, which is a fairly shallow and slightly enclosed area of water for a very long time. Very long time, since 1952. Huge amounts. Now, what we found, using small area data from Wales Cancer Registry, that there was an increase in childhood cancer, increase in childhood leukemia, and adult cancers also, with a very strange trend from the sea, showing a very sharp increase as you get very close to the coast. Around about that time, we had this data from the Wales Cancer Registry, which showed this, and at that point, 1995, Wales Cancer Registry was sacked, all of them. The entire registry was shut down, everybody was sacked. The data was taken off the Welsh office computer, and about a year passed, and then this bloke Stewart came along with this new operation called the Wales Cancer Intelligence and Surveillance Unit. He then attacked our studies, which by then had become translated into two BBC documentaries on Welsh television. And together with the Committee on Medical Aspects of Radiation Environment, who are the principal people who advise the government on radiation and health in this country, he just attacked, and rubbished everything that we did. He took 15% of the children off the Wales Cancer Registry database. You can see that by comparing the Wales Cancer Registry annual data with his annual data. So 15% of the children were just miraculously brought back to life. And actually, when I accused them of bringing more people back to life than Jesus Christ, he said I was being blasphemous. But anyway, it was true. So he then organized a new study to show that there was no effect. But then in 2004, another Welsh TV company went and actually knocked on doors and found the children with leukemia. Gosh, you know, here he is, George, and there's Fred, and there's Bill. And so it wasn't a question of cancer registry data anymore, we had the children. Of course, we didn't have all the children, but we had enough of the children to be able to make an epidemiological study. And that showed that by that time, 2004, the risk for childhood leukemia and brain tumours around the area which was most contaminated had gone up to about 20-fold, 20 times the national average. So it's not a small increase. So what Stewart did, he changed his analysis in order to alter the base population. So he brought in the wrong base population, he inflated the base population by 4 times, which reduced the statistical significance of the cluster that I had discovered. And he wrote a paper about this, which was then sent to the Welsh office. It was published by the Welsh office, it went on the internet. The Committee on Medical Aspects of Radiation and the Environment backed him up and so on. And so, as usual, I was in the doghouse for not knowing how to do statistics and so on. Of course he was wrong, he'd used the wrong data. So I complained to the chair of the Royal, president of the Royal College of Physicians. He promised to investigate. I wrote demanding an apology. Eventually, it was agreed that Stewart was wrong, and he had to apologize. So I got a paper into the Journal of whatever it was, the Royal College of Physicians, arguing that this was the case. But nothing has happened. The man is still there. He's still in charge of cancer registry in Wales. He's still an advisor to the government on whether or not there is a problem with radiation around the Irish Sea, and whether any children are dying or not. So nothing has happened. So should he go to jail? I think probably yes. These are just roughly the results that I've been referring to. This is a relative risk for adults, based on all the small area data and based on national averages. These are relative risks based on national averages. And for children, you can see also. But by now, for children up along the North Wales coast, it's gone up to about 15 to 20 times in terms of brain tumours and leukemias. Ray Cartwright. Cartwright is the Director of Epidemiology of the Cancer Research Campaign, and he was co-author of the largest childhood leukemia study that has been done. This is the UK-CCCI Joint Cancer Charity Study that the government funded, jointly funded, into the cause of childhood leukemia. Now, in 1990, Cartwright worked with Professor Alexander and a few others looking at the levels of childhood leukemia near estuaries that were contaminated with ionizing radiation. He wrote a paper on this, which was published in the peer review literature, in which he discovered that there was a significant association between living near radioactively contaminated estuaries in the west of England and childhood leukemia incidents. Right. So you'd think he might think that there might be a relationship between the two things. But when he came to be translated into the head of epidemiology of the cancer research campaign, and to be put in charge of this hugely expensive study, which already had ionizing radiation as one of its possible causes of leukemia, he excluded it. So this study that cost a huge amount of money, and it was paid for by the money that people put in their pockets and the mothers of children who had died and all of the people who paid for trying to find the cause of this dreadful disease, all of this money went into a study which didn't look at the most likely cause. Now, isn't that extraordinary? Because he decided to exclude it. Okay, so when the results of this study were given out at a public meeting in London, my colleague Bramhall said to him, why didn't you look at the ionizing radiation, given that you had already discovered that there was an association? He published it in a paper in 1990. And he was called on the stage at the time, he was a bit concerned, so he said, oh well, because we did another study after that showed that it was an artifact, it showed that it wasn't a real effect. Okay, so everybody's quiet. So Bramhall then wrote to him and asked him, can we see the study? Of course there was no study. He wrote 3 times asking for this study, it didn't exist. And in 1999 or 2000, we eventually got a study which one of his BSc students, Francis Lloyd, had written. You know, it had taken about 6 months, it was part of a degree. And it was a completely absurd study, and it was related to a different set of estuaries, and all the numbers were wrong, and it was just nonsense. But whether it was right or not, you had to ask the question how it could be that a 99 study had retrospectively altered his decision about whether or not to look at ionizing radiation in 1993. It's just not possible, unless he had some kind of prescient, ghostly dream about the future that would have showed this. But anyway, so that leaves Cartwright in a bad position. So we shocked him up to the British Medical Association, Fitness to Practice Directorate, And they talked about it, and they pondered about it, and they thought about it, and eventually they asked him to write an apology to us for misleading us in public. And that was it. Then Cartwright's still the head of epidemiology for the cancer research campaign. Now, you don't get much higher than that, I can tell you. That's the top man. I mean, apart from those people in IARC, he's the guy who decides whether you've got cancer or not, you know, following some environmental exposure. Okay, well, I've said all of this. Right, in 1983, when the Sellafield leukemia cluster was discovered, by a television company, incidentally, no, not by the public health people, but by Yorkshire Television, there was a public inquiry that was chaired by Sir Douglas Black. And Black took evidence from everybody about what the possible cause was. The National Radiological Protection Board came and told him that it couldn't possibly be ionising radiation because the doses were too small. These were doses based on the study of Japanese Hiroshima survivors, and they had little to do with internal radiation, and there were all sorts of flaws. So Black suggested that two new operations be set up to look into this, and one is the Committee on Medical Aspects of Radiation in the Environment, and Bridges very rapidly became the chair of CAMARI, this committee, who consistently, throughout the whole time that he was chair, that was right up till recently, and he retired about 2 years ago, just about the time that the Cherry Committee stopped. He acted as a sort of doorkeeper to any evidence that showed that there was a problem with ionising radiation and health from internal radionuclides. There was an endless battle between Bridges and the people who were arguing that there was a problem. Now, in 2000, I wrote to Bridges, and I asked him to look at the evidence from the Chernobyl infants, from these infant leukemias, because after all, if you're in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl accident, that's about the only thing that affects you is the Chernobyl accident. It's a very, very precisely defined cohort. It's a bit like taking if I'm a chemist, I can take some blue liquid in a test tube and some red liquid, and I can mix them together and get a green precipitate. Now, you can't usually do that with people, you know, because epidemiology is more complicated. Lots of different things happen to people. So if you say, this child has got leukemia because she lives near Sellafield, they can say, but of course it could be the chemicals, you know, or it could be that there's some population mixing or whatever, you know, so there's always a way out. But in the case of children who are in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl accident, there's no way out, because that all they can have is the Chernobyl accident. So choose the cohort, and it's internal radiation. So in five different countries in Europe, this effect existed. And it was published by different groups, and it was all statistically significant from every group. And if you do a meta-analysis, it's highly significant. So this is an effect. So I wrote to CAMARI and I suggested that they look at this. So immediately Bridges wrote back and said he was going to send it to the transgenerational subcommittee of CAMARI, you see. So not the whole of CAMARI, who are 13 people, some of whom might actually be honest. And so CAMARI, Bridges sent it down to this transgenerational subcommittee, who later I found, because this was leaked to me, people send me things in brown envelopes and say this has happened and that's happened and so on. And I talked to one of the members of this committee. There were three members of this committee, and one of them who I talked to wasn't there at the time. So there were only two members of this committee, and one of them was Bridges, the other one was Cartwright, who we already met. So Bridges wrote back to me and he said, this is a very interesting discovery, and we will bear it in mind in case we have to look at it again in the future. What he meant, I suppose, if there was another Chernobyl accident, and if it occurred again, then he might think, well, perhaps we've got to wait for a third Chernobyl accident and see if it also happens again, then we might do something. So that's Bridges. Now, finally, I come to the Royal Society. Here we are, the Royal Society. Now, the Royal Society, in 2001, set up the Royal Society Committee on Depleted Uranium. There have been a huge load of arguments about the health effects of depleted uranium following various discoveries of ill health in veterans and in people who lived in areas where these depleted uranium munitions had been used. When these uranium munitions hit a target, they produce vast clouds of very tiny particles, microscopic particles, nanoparticles almost, mean diameter about 100 nanometers. And they're just like a gas, so they float all over the place and they get inhaled and they go through into the lymphatic system and basically they can get anywhere in the body. Question is, do they cause the effects that everybody was suggesting that they cause? So, of course, the conventional risk model, that one of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, the one that's behind all of these arguments that I've been talking about, the one that says that the Sellafield leukemia children couldn't have a causal relationship with the ionization from ionizing radioactivity from Sellafield and so on. Bringing this argument forward suggests that there's not enough absorbed dose to cause the effects that the vets are saying are happening and that the Iraqi people are saying are happening. These are genotoxic effects. You have effects of children being born with limb deficiencies. You have all sorts of cancers. You have childhood leukemias. You have quite horrifying effects from the use of depleted uranium. Everyone, all the WHO and UNSCEAR and BEIR, all of the major agencies said, by application of this risk model, the external risk model, there couldn't be a problem with uranium. It was too weakly radioactive and the dose was too small. But of course nobody believed them. So what happened was somebody asked the Royal Society to set up a committee to look into it. Why the Royal Society? Well, I mean, is it because somebody at the Royal Society woke up one morning and thought, wow, let's have a committee on depleted uranium? I don't think so. I think probably somebody suggested that the Royal Society represented the ultimate position with regard to any scientific problem. So if you don't believe all of the other people who are all crooks, at least you're going to believe the Royal Society, because they're not crooks, you know. I mean, there you are. Yeah, they all are. Look, you've got Hooke and you've got Newton and you've got all of these people, members of the Royal Society. How could they be crooks? Okay. I thought they were trying to use the name of the Royal Society to reassure the veterans, and they asked me to give evidence, mainly because I was suggested to them by Meacher, who at that time was the environment minister. Now, Brian Spratt was made the chair of this group, the Royal Society Committee, and the advisor on radiological effects is our old friend Dudley Goodhead, who I introduced at the beginning. So you can see there are not an awful lot of people in this game, you know? The committee took evidence from many scientists, and they eventually produced two reports. The first report, which was the radiological one, concluded that two things. First of all, the weapon-produced dust did not travel far from the impact site, so it was not a weapon of mass destruction, because it only affected people at the point that it hit. And the second thing was that unless they inhaled in what they call choking quantities, it's sort of like a new dose description, there would be no radiological hazard. Yes, one choking unit, that country. Oh, so the chap has lung cancer, so he must have had at least five choking units. So, anyway, so I gave evidence to the Royal Society Committee saying that the dust was a normal exposure, and that such exposures cause high local internal doses. So close to the particle, the dose is very high. It's an alpha emitter. And, of course, far away from the particle, there's no dose at all. So if you dilute the whole thing into the body, you get a low dose. But as far as the cell is concerned, where the particle is, the cell doesn't know that, you know. It says, hey, wow, that hurts. And I brought various bits of evidence, all of which were ignored. And I also was asked by the veteran to give a response to their final report in 2001. Okay. And I wrote this report. And as a result of this, because, again, nobody really believed the Royal Society, the military decided to set up the Depleted Uranium Oversight Board to look at the concentrations of uranium in the urine. And also to look at the science. So we looked at the science, and Spratt was on this committee, and so was I. So in the 4 years of the DU, there were many, many new studies published in the peer review literature. You know, probably 10 or 20 studies, cell biology studies, epidemiological studies, showing that uranium could not be considered in the same way. For some reason, again, there was no mechanism, for some reason, uranium had some effect which was anomalous. That is to say, according to its intrinsic radioactivity, it had much more effect on the human body. It produced huge amounts of chromosome damage. In one study, it produced the same amount of chromosome damage as 150 millisieverts of radiation. But you can relate chromosome damage to ionizing radiation. So I brought all of these arguments to the meeting and to Brian Spratt. You have to remember now that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people have died by this time. You know, the first use of uranium was in 1991, then in 2001 in Kosovo and in the Balkans, and now 2003 it was being used. We were still sitting, and by that time we were looking at all this evidence that uranium had an anomalous effect. And one of the arguments that I brought forward was one that I made in 2003 to the Cherry Committee, which was something that occurred to me as obvious, but like all things that are obvious, you know, it's only obvious when you think about them. And that was that uranium has the highest atomic number of any element on Earth. And because of that, because of the absorption of gamma rays being proportional to the fourth power of the atomic number, uranium actually absorbs more gamma rays than anything else on Earth. And that's why it's used as a shield. You use depleted uranium as a shield against radiation. If you go to an X-ray department of many hospitals, you find that there's uranium shields or lead shield. Lead has got a high atomic number too. Lead is 82. Uranium is 92. So these high atomic number elements absorb gamma radiation from natural background. Well, mostly it doesn't matter, because what happens is that all of the energy absorbed goes into the metal and shoots around the inside, lots of electrons fly around, and it gets very slightly hotter. That's not a problem. But it becomes a problem if you've got a tiny little particle, because there's nowhere for the electrons to fly around it. They just come straight out of the particle, you see. So what uranium is doing is it's amplifying the natural background from within the body, and it's worse than that. Because in 1992, a guy called Nielsen, publishing in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, showed that uranium bound to DNA with an affinity constant of 10 to the 10, which is an enormously high affinity constant. And this was known, because in 1960-62, Huxley had already started publishing papers about how you should use uranium in order to image the DNA. If you put uranyl acetate into a cell culture, it goes straight under the DNA. And so when you take an X-ray, or if you look through an electron microscope, that's how you see the DNA. Use uranium for imaging, because it absorbs this stuff. And if it absorbs gamma rays, then it means that anyone with uranium inside them are going to absorb the gamma rays, and they're going to get an enhanced radiation dose from natural background. So I asked Brett, what should I do about this? Like I said, if this is right, this is a mechanism. This one might not be the only one, but it's an interesting mechanism, and it should be looked into, because actually a lot of people are dying, you know, and what it suggests is that you were wrong on the Royal Society Committee. So as chair of the Royal Society Committee, maybe you should do something about this. And he said, send it to the Royal Society Journal, and if they accept it, if they publish it, then the Royal Society Committee will have to be reconvened, they'll have to take notice. In 2005, meanwhile, this guy in America, publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine, found that gold particles enhance the radiation from X-rays. And he used to use gold particles. He actually patented gold particles as a method of enhancing X radiation into tumors. So you'd inject a load of gold nanoparticles, give a load of X-rays, the tumor disappears. He did this in mice and in rats. This was a study. So it showed that this effect is real. Okay. So I sent two papers to the Royal Society. They were immediately unsubmitted. They went to the Royal Society Proceedings B, with a letter saying that Brian Spratt suggested I send them, and he's the chair of the RAID, and all this stuff, you know, and I gave evidence to, and I was on the DUOB, and this and that. So they knew what the score was. They unsubmitted both of these papers. So I phoned up the Royal Society, and I said, look, this isn't good enough. You know, I'm going to come and chain myself to the railings. You better do something about this. So they said, oh, yeah, all right, send them to a new journal we've got called Interface, because it's not really biology. You know? First of all, they said send it to physics, but I mean, no way. I mean, as soon as when it comes to physics, I have to take out the garlic and stuff. All right. So they said send it to the Interface, which is the interface between biology and physics. Well, fair enough, you know, this was the interface between biology and physics. So I sent these papers along, and after about 6 weeks, took a bit longer than usual, they were rejected. But at the same time, in that period of time, three referees that these papers had been sent to all phoned me up and said that they'd received the papers. They were really interesting, and they recommended that they be published. Okay? So I've got three referees. There were only three referees that they sent the first paper to, and all three recommended publication. And yet this guy Bonfield, who is the editor, so William Bonfield, FRS, well, he's not Sir yet, but he's going the right way to become one. His area of research is prosthetic materials. Now, he has presumably a lot of connection with companies that make prosthetic materials. You must know that these are things they put inside you. Yeah? And a lot of these things contain platinum, gold, and inert materials with high atomic number. And, of course, it's already known that people who have gold inside them do have problems with cancer. You know, the gold can disappear away from the site of the implant, and it can end up somewhere else. So I thought this was not good enough. You know, so he said there was pressure on space in the journal. So I complained to the in-house editor, this chap called Tim Holt. He was quite nice. I made the obvious points, you know, that I'm making to you about bias and so forth, and about the Royal Society. And he suggested, why don't I go and publish it in some other journal? See. But I said, no. I said, the Royal Society are the people who said that uranium was safe. So the Royal Society have to be the people who say that it isn't safe. Because what will happen if I go to some, you know, journal like Environmental Digest or the Journal of Mickey Mouse Research or something, what will happen is that it won't get incorporated into any of the science policy stuff. That's the point. Whereas if it goes to the Royal Society, it has to, see? And that's why it was rejected. That's my point. That's why it was rejected. And then they again rejected it after some discussion. So I contacted the Assistant Secretary of the Royal Society, Peter Collins, and he said that the journal Royal Society Interface was not part of the Royal Society. And so, despite the name, you know, the name was confusing. I said, I know it's confusing. What's confusing? I can tell you. And he said, don't mind about that. I'll talk to Cornfield. So anyway, of course, he did nothing because it was not part of the Royal Society. So the papers were rejected. So then the USA-based oversight board, including 41 scientists and experts, wrote a letter saying, you know, this is disgraceful, blah, blah, blah. So that's my point, really. I mean, my question to you now, to complete all of this, is are these people I have presented guilty of crimes? Are they guilty of stupidity or cowardice? Are they innocent? Did the children who died because they were in the womb at the time of Chernobyl die because they represented that chance level? And what about the BSC victims or the Sellafield leukemia children? And having listened to Goodhead and later seen that new research showed Goodhead's to be wrong, should Spratt have reconvened the committee and saved thousands of lives? Because he would have done. If he'd have done this in 2002, it may be that they wouldn't have used depleted uranium in Gulf War II. And that uranium didn't just affect the people in Iraq. I can tell you it came here. We measured it in the Aldermaston air filters. And also, more recently, I've met with it again in Los Angeles, where it's been picked up by filters near the rocket-going park. So, should Darby and Dolby be prosecuted for splicing together two separate cancer series and to remove evidence that fallout caused child leukemia and failing to cite earlier Danish evidence in papers and pretending that the data was destroyed? But incidentally, when we asked them about this, she said, oh, we knew all about the Danish data. I mean, honestly, in committee, we're all sitting there and we spent months and months tracking this stuff down and complaining to the BMJ and so on. And then at the point when she was asked to explain it, she said, well, we knew about the Danish data, and we were doing this new research to see if it was just a statistical clip. And then we never saw her after that. She didn't come back to the committee. And should these other scientists have introduced, you know, should they suffer some prosecution? And not just these. I mean, I just chose these people more or less at random. They're like the main ones. But there are lots of others that I could name. Many of them are named. And many of the evidence that I have to present that they have been biased, to put it mildly, is in that book, which you all can read if you want. The question is, back to the original one, there is no law against such dishonesty. There's no independent committee on scientific. My suggestion here is that perhaps we should have come out. Because in 1997, at a similar meeting of the European STOA group in Brussels, I suggested when the ICRP said, you do not have to listen to us, Valentin, he said, we are just an independent charity. We just make decisions about what we think is right. You can listen to anybody you like. So at that point, I decided to set up the European Committee on Radiation Risk, which has been very successful. So I just suggest somebody, and not me, incidentally, because I've got enough on my plate, sets up the British or the UK Institute or Committee for Scientific Dishonesty and take evidence. It's not difficult. It can be done. And it doesn't cost an awful lot. And finally, here are some scientists who aren't biased, and you can exclude me because I am biased. But we have John Goldsmith here, Ed Radford, who was an original member of the International Commission on Radiological Protection and argued with them and resigned over it. And so, and as a result of that, he lost a lot of money and status and friends and job and so on, and he had to leave America in England. Ernest Sternglass, who started all this, more or less the first person to blow the whistle on ionizing radiation, and who actually managed to get to the president, President Kennedy, by writing an article not in the peer review literature, but in Playboy. And President Kennedy, of course, reads Playboy, or did, foil him, and he shot him. And so he signed the test ban treaty with Chris John and stopped the atmospheric weight-incest fallout, the same fallout that caused that increase in childhood leukemia in Denmark and similar increases in cancer at the time. And certainly was the cause of the present cancer epidemic. My guns and my saddle
will always be. This show and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available at the MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Just like